Matthew 26, 27, 28 is the payoff, except makes it sound like everything leading up to this has been drudgery. Well, it certainly hasn't, but this is high holy ground. We're looking at the last night, the arrest, the trials, the crucifixion, the burial, and the resurrection. Okay. Chapter 26, verse 1, it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings. This is all the sayings is the Olivet Discourse, as we would call it. He said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified." So it's the Passover season. What makes the Last Supper a Jewish Seder meal? If it's the Passover in 2 days, which is the 14th of Nisan, then today would be, when he says that, it would be the 12th of Nisan. He predicts, not the first time, his betrayal and his crucifixion. I wonder at what point they were getting it. Then assembled together the chief priests, so this is him and his band, and there's another assembly going on. Assembled together, chief priests, the scribes, the elders, people under the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, "Not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people." Now, last time we met with these guys, it was, "Ye hypocrites, ye this, ye that." It was the chapter of the hypocrite chapter. And they, so all the gloves are off. There's no niceties. There's no pretending anymore. They've barely tolerated him. He cleansed the temple. He told, when they said, "Surely you don't want them to be ascribing to you the Christhood, the Son of David," he said, "Yeah, if these stop crying out, the rocks would shout out," you know. So everything's out in the open now, and here they are. This is their heart. It always was their heart. But they said, "Not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people." When did he die? On the feast day. They're not driving. They think they are. They think they're in control of something. You know, America could go very bad in a hurry, and the people who are badening it, they always think they're in control. Ultimately, God. Well, why would God let things go very bad in America? Indeed. Why hasn't he? I guess it's probably the better question. No, we can't. Because everyone's in town. It's a big deal. It's a holiday. What does the holiday celebrate? It celebrates their freedom from the oppression of Egypt. The Romans know that? Of course they know that. So they've stepped up the guards. Everybody's in town. Herod's in town. Is he up in Caesarea Philippi? Is the Pontius Pilate, at Caesarea Philippi? No, they're right there in Jerusalem. It's like I say, when they go to see him, they don't have to go anywhere. It's a big deal. And we don't want to mar the feast by taking care of this guy, but we have to take care of him. Now, when Jesus was in Bethany, house of sorrow, right? In the house of Simon the leper, ostensibly an ex-leper, right? I don't know, like active leprosy is like hosting parties, right? They're the ones who are unclean. So we have to think that he's Simon the ex-leper. Some want to make him the father of Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, and all we know is Bethany. So it's the same town as them, but I don't know. I've never read anything that makes him related to them at all, except she's there. And so is Lazarus, and so is Mary, according to other Gospels. This is not the Last Supper. This is before that. It's 2 days before remember. Okay, the house of Simon the leper, there came unto him a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointment. Very precious, I guess, it's about a year's wage, and poured it on his head as he sat at meat. And when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, to what purpose is this waste? For this ointment might have been sold for much and given to the poor. And Jesus understood it, and he said unto them, why trouble ye the woman? For she hath wrought a good work upon me. For ye have the poor always with you, but me you have not always. For in that she hath poured the ointment on my body, she did it for my burial. Verily I say unto you, wherever this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, this shall also this, as this woman hath done, be told for a memorial of her. That's it. That's the last straw. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went unto the chief priests and said unto them, what will ye give me, and I will deliver him unto you? And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. Let's read the same in John chapter 12, because it gives us some more information, and I think that extra information is beneficial in this. John chapter 12... Then took Mary a pound of ointment of spikenard. Why didn't Matthew name her? Surely he would know who it was. Because she's probably still alive at this point. And he names her, he dimes her out as a disciple of Jesus Christ for whatever that's worth. When Matthew wrote his gospel, was the coast clear, I guess is the word. Was it okay to name yourself as a disciple? Why does John bother to name her then? Because she's probably dead. He wrote it very late. He might have wrote it, some people think, after the book of Revelation. I don't know that. Scholars debate these things. I don't know. But let's say it's written very late. Mary's dead. What are you going to do? Dig her up and yell at her? Once you're dead, there's no persecution, right? So it was Mary, and it was Mary of Mary, look at the verse. Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. They made him a supper. Where? At the house of Simon the leper, no doubt. Martha served, because that's what she does. Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him. By the way, they represent the three ways that we can relate to Jesus Christ. Martha is serving, Lazarus is fellowshipping, Mary is, in a word, worshiping. Yes, it was for her burial, but it was worth it. She's saying, in essence, he's worth a year's wage for me just to pour out, to anoint him for his burial. Worship means to ascribe worth. Certainly she's doing that. And took Mary a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. Then said one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, oh, I see, Simon's son, who should betray him. Why was this not ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? People who criticize worship are represented here by none other than Judas Iscariot. So if I was somebody who had a problem with worship, I would change my tune. I don't want my spokesman to be Judas. Why wasn't this sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? It says 300 pence. It's 300 denarius, 300 days' wages. So that's why we say about a year's wages, because there's 300-ish working days. If you get 52 Sabbaths plus holidays, you know, plus or minus, it's a year's wage, right? This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag and bare what was put therein. What's he doing then? He's virtue signaling. We're driving off the interstate, or coming out of the whatever store or whatever street, and there in a median is somebody with the cardboard sign. We know they take drugs. Does the person who stops and gives them a $20 bill know they take drugs? I think so. Why do they do it? Virtue signaling. I don't care where this goes. I just care that people look and see how sanctimonious I am. Are they trying to help? If I give them every benefit of every doubt at this late date, yeah. So every time I see this, I don't say, wow, so virtuous. I think, oh my goodness, I can't believe. You must have so much money, you just give it away so people can take drugs. Or I think, you're not helping. You're not helping the situation. If nobody gave them any money ever, how long would it take for that whole thing to dry up? You're not helping. They would have to dry out another way. They would have to. But anyway, virtue signaling is a real thing, and it was in this day as well. He didn't care about the poor. He was a thief. He had the bag and bare what was put therein. Then said Jesus, let her alone, against the day of my burying hath she kept this. For the poor always ye have with you, but you don't always have me. Yeah, this is interesting to me. Much people of the Jews therefore knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests consulted they might put Lazarus also to death. Wow. Lazarus can't catch a break, huh? Anyway, back to Matthew chapter 26. The poor you're going to have with you always. Why is that? Back in LBJ, the Great Society, the war on poverty, we're going to win. We're going to make it all. So we give people houses. We give them cell phones. We give them money, food, SNAP benefits. These are good things, right? Sometimes they can be. Then how come we still have poor people? One, Jesus said, there's always going to be poor people. Why did he say that? Because there's two things. Sometimes people have poverty mentality. And then there's drugs. You can't afford drugs. Okay, I don't know, if you're a country western music person and you're every song you put out sells in the millions of copies, or rock and roll, or some sort of entertainer, or a sports figure, maybe you can afford drugs. Most times it will make you homeless. You can't afford drugs and your rent, you can't afford drugs and the electric bill, so it just devolves to just drugs. So it doesn't matter if you give somebody a SNAP card. They're going to try to sell the SNAP benefits to somebody and get money so they can buy more drugs. That's the way it works. So that's one of the reasons for homelessness. You put somebody in a home, and it's going to ruin it. They're going to strip everything out of it, including the copper wire, trying to sell whatever they can get for pennies on the dollar so they can get more drugs. And then there's this thing called a poverty spirit. I think there's a spiritual dimension to this. Satan comes what? To steal, kill, and destroy. Steal. He would make you poor. He doesn't want to bless you with wealth and riches and prosperity. Your Heavenly Father does, but you're always going to have poor people because there's always going to be people who don't know what to do with money, don't know how to. And you know, these people buy lottery tickets and they become instant millionaires. They win the, you know, mega bucks or this or that. And 4 years later, they're right back to where they were without anything to show for it. Why is that? Poverty mentality and poverty spirit. If they have that introduced all that money all of a sudden. They wouldn't know how to. Who's wealthy? The people who worked hard their whole life, saved, scrimped, took an adventure, took some risk, did a business, turned themselves inside out, made the business work. They understand the value of a dollar. They still have their dollar. Probably the first one. It's probably up in their dry cleaning establishment or their Chinese restaurant or their barbershop or whatever that made them wealthy, right? But you're going to have the poor always. Now, this isn't about that, but I wanted to just kind of, while we were here, she poured my ointment on the body. She did it for my burial. Verily, I say unto you, wherever this gospel be preached in the whole world, there shall also this woman hath done, be told for a memorial of her. Then one of the 12 called Judas Iscariot, because he was openly rebuked by Jesus. It's not mentioned in Matthew, it's mentioned in John. He was kind of outed, and so he's, oh man, I just lost a whole year's wage. Let me get what I can, okay? What will you give me, and I will deliver him up unto you? And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. I would commend to you studying Judas. He's very, very interesting. Not interesting in the sense of fascinating, you know, I want to model my life after him. But how do you be with Jesus for over 3 years? He sends you out with the other 70. The 70 or 72, sends you out and you have power over demons and sickness, and you preach the gospel, people's lives are turned upside down, or right side up, we should say. You see him heal lepers, you see him raise people from the dead. He walks on water. You were in that ship too. He washed your feet along with the other 11 disciples. And the whole time you're thinking, I gotta... Well, because maybe you're thinking, okay, kingdom time, I'm going to be the treasurer in the kingdom. That'll be very lucrative for me. His heart was always not set on Jesus Christ. But when he realized, okay, this isn't going the way I thought it was going to go, how do you betray Jesus Christ? How do you do that? It's a remarkable study, I think. Remarkable in a very negative, strong negative way. What will he give me if I deliver him unto you? And they said, name your price. I want 1 billion shekels. And they said, okay. What? 30 pieces of silver. Now, I have a gloss. It says $52.80. It depends when your Bible is. It talks about the price of silver. I saw one of the coins, not one of the very coins, but one of the coins that probably was used that a friend of mine had. It's nothing that you would covet to the point. You know, they say everyone has their price. I don't believe that. I don't believe that at all. But some, before they shipwrecked their whole lives, they would want a king's ransom. This is not a lot of money by anyone's standards. Why 30 pieces of silver? Well, that's a wounded slave in the Old Testament, the price, if you know, when you know whose ox is gored and all that, and if you wound a slave, you gotta pay for the time that he missed until he gets healthy again that he can work. There's all this stuff, but if he dies and it's what you owe the guy is 30 pieces of silver. For a wounded slave. I can't, that's somewhere in my brain. But more interesting to me is Zechariah. Zechariah 11. And this is Zechariah, I'm studying through it with Chuck Missler. He's gone on, but his words endure, and they still have that program 6640. And right now he's on Zechariah 11, but he didn't get this far yet. It's one of my favorite chapters in Zechariah. Zechariah is a hard book to me. There's that the two staffs, beauty and oh, I don't know, I cut out 1 month, feed the flock, poor. Two staves, one I call beauty, the other I call bands. I took my staff, verse 10, even beauty, cut it asunder, which might break my covenant with, which I had made with all the people. It was broken, verse 11, in that day, and so the poor of the flock, they waited upon me, knew that it was the word of the Lord. And I said unto them, Zechariah talking to the poor, if you think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, cast it unto the potter. These 30 pieces of silver, who ends up with it? The potter. Interesting, because that's a very specific prediction, isn't it? I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Then I cut asunder my understanding, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood. And goes on and on like that. And then it starts talking about the idol shepherd. The only description I know in both Old and New Testament of the Antichrist. But that's a story for another time, and so we'll forbear. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 26, the 30 pieces of silver that end up in the potter's house. From that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. Jesus knows that. He's been calling the shots. Look it back, chapter 26, verse 1, verse 2. You know that after 2 days of the feast of the Passover, the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. He's going to renounce it at the Last Supper as well. So now, it's out. Okay, he's done the deed. He's collected the money, and now he's just looking for the opportunity. Now, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, okay, the whole week is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's actually the 15th of Nisan, but the words Passover and Unleavened Bread are used interchangeably. Also, the Feast of First Fruits is encompassed in that week. But it's here it's called the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's the day of Passover. So he's preparing the Passover meal. The disciples came to Jesus saying unto him, where wilt thou that we prepare for thee to eat the Passover, first day of Unleavened Bread? 14th of Nisan. And he said, go into the city to such a man and say unto him, the master saith, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at the house with my disciples. Okay, we're told in one gospel, go into the city, you'll see a man carrying a pitcher of water, which, by the way, I'm not trying to be sexist, this is women's work. This would be atypical. You think, there's guys everywhere walking up and down carrying water. No. She's sick, she's in bed with the flu, I don't know. She's gone to the store to buy provisions. The marketplace, I don't know, but this guy's carrying water. And he says where he stops, wherever he goes, the house he goes in, go to the master of the house and say, hey, you got a room because my master wants to prepare a Passover here, and he's going to show you an upper room furnished all set, et cetera, et cetera. Here, it's slightly different. Go to the city to such a man and say to him, the master saith, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at thy house with thy disciples. Why did he do that? Why didn't he say, okay, go down to Straight Street or Baker's Way or, okay, the third place on the left, because then Judas would know it. Here, James and John, or whoever he sends, right, Philip and Bartholomew, you guys go, and the first guy you see carrying a pitcher of water, why? Because Judas couldn't betray him then. And he's going to do this, but he's going to do it his way. He's not going to be betrayed until it's time. He's got to establish some things and say some things. We got a chapter here, basically. The whole last week of Jesus' life is the majority of the book of John. In the other Gospels, it's just a chapter and a half. The disciples did as Jesus had appointed them, and they made ready the Passover. That's why we say that the Last Supper was a Passover. Now, when the even was come, he sat down with the 12. And as they did eat, he said, "Verily I say unto you, that one of you shall betray me." Okay? We're celebrating the Passover. Hey, pass the bitter herbs. Hey, more of that lamb, please. You know, they get the sop in the dish. They're just doing this. They're, you know, eating. It's a celebration. One of you shall betray me. And they were exceeding sorrowful, wouldn't you be? And began every one of them to say unto him, "Lord, is it I?" Now I see this. I see this. I'm aware of how capable I am to destroy, to sin, to disappoint, to... And betrayal doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to sell you for 30 pieces of silver. I mean, like, has anyone said, "Hey, thanks, I told you this in confidence, and you go blabbing it all over the world. Thanks for stabbing me in the back and stuff," and you may be guilty of what they said. Maybe you didn't mean it that way, or maybe you maliciously did. I don't know, but, you know, he's not accusing them all of being Judas or anything, but they take this right to heart, and they want, "Wait a second, one of you is going to betray you. Not me, is it?" I don't know. I don't know if anyone else, you know, feels like that way, like they could. I'd want to know. I'd want to clear myself. He answered and said, "He that dippeth his hand with me in the dish, the same shall betray me." By the way, so the dishes are put around, and slight reaching is okay. And this kind of, it's like either John or Judas. John's on his right hand, Judas is at his left. The let's say, you know, you got a chip dip or salsa or something like that, and you got your Fritos or your chips or whatever, and you think of it like that, where they the one who dippeth his hand with me in the dish, the same shall betray me. Now in John, Gospel of John, Peter says to John, "Ask him who it is." You know what I mean? Jesus is asked by John, "Who's going to betray you?" And he says, "When I dip the sop into the dish and hand it, you'll know," kind of. So he dips it and hands it to Judas. By the way, that's why we know Judas was right there. He didn't toss it down the end of the table. He handed it to him. And this is honor. This is bestowing honor on somebody to do that. Different culture. You know, "I'll dip my own chips, thank you very much," you know what I mean? But it's a different culture, you got to remember. But anyway, the one that dips his hand in the dish. "The Son of Man goeth, as is written of him, but woe unto him by whom the man, woe unto that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It had been good for that man if he had not been born." Boy, you can say that about everyone in hell, but of course, is Judas in hell? Yeah. Yeah. The son of perdition? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sorry, but yeah. If he was in heaven, Jesus couldn't say it was good for that guy who'd never been born. Never been born. How do you talk about something that's never been? He can say it with certainty. "Then Judas, which betrayed him, answered and said, Master, is it I? He said unto him, Thou hast said." We'd say it this way, "You said it." And not, "You said it, bub." It's "as you have said." It's an answer in the affirmative, yes. "Is it I?" Yeah. Matter of fact, yeah. This is after he had washed his feet. At this point, does Judas get up and go? Very hotly debated. I think so. Because the next thing we have is what we would call communion. And I can't picture in my own mind that close, intimate, hey, this is my body given for you, and Judas partaking and being part of that. Prove me wrong. Show me the verse that I'm missing. He took the cup. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. Big debate, again, is this actually his body? Is it symbolic of his body? He took bread, blessed it, and break it. This is my body. Hey, look at this. Crunch, crunch, crunch. That's my body. He also said he was the door. He also said he was the good shepherd. He said he was the light of the world. Did he? How fluorescent was he actually? Very. Not in measured in lumens, measured in people receiving sight, understanding, having light dawn upon them. Was he really the door? Yes. A wooden, oaken, swinging on a hinge door? No, that's silly. So you have to determine, but it's to me, it's obvious enough. My body is true bread indeed, he says in John chapter 6. And so the disciples came and took a bite out of him. The words that I speak, they're spirit and they're truth. Being Catholic, and this is the biggest debate, and this is why a lot of Catholics won't even give you the time of day. Oh, we're the only ones who do it right, the whole communion thing. And it kind of has that idea of, I don't want to say cannibalism, but cannibalism. I don't see any other way around it. Partake of this, my broken body. Believe equals salvation, all through Scripture. And the whole thing about communion is you keep partaking of it and it gives you graces that you build up and you G&H trading stamps that you get your steak knives with later on when you fill up books and books and books of them. That's the whole thing. That's the whole idea. And we're doing it right and you're not doing it right and we believe on him. We don't, it wouldn't matter if it was, in the sense of you're not collecting anything. You're not, it doesn't get you. Take, eat, this is my body. Partake of me. Believe is kind of the idea. He took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, drink ye all of it. For this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. And there's four cups. This is, they think, is the third cup, but it doesn't say that anywhere that I know. It just, if you do a Seder, it's the bringing out, it's all very, and so the reason I don't learn about it and try to push that narrative is because I'm not so sold on it myself. And then we can have the Lord's Supper without knowing which cup it was that he actually used in this. All we know, it's wine. Is it grape juice? Can't be. Grapes haven't grown yet. It's the spring. They have the same growing season as we do. So it would be last year's grapes, and so it's either vinegar or you made wine out of it, but it wouldn't, because grapes would have turned to raisins at this point, and if it was fresh grape juice back when you made it in September or October, whenever, by this point it would have turned. So it's wine that they made. Small point. So why don't we use actual wine? Because the whole thing's symbolic anyway. I know there are churches that do that. I don't want to be one of them. I don't want to... In America, in the 21st century, alcohol is a scourge of this nation. I think bring back prohibition. I'm just not enamored by alcohol. I just don't think it's a benefit. I've never seen it be a benefit. This blood of grapes is it's a picture of my blood. This is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. See? That's the whole point. I say unto you, I'll not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. What is he talking about, his Father's kingdom? I think this is the kingdom, the kingdom age. Is it going to be a Seder or a something? Marriage supper of the Lamb? I don't know. People say, well, you know, Jesus drank wine, so I can drink wine. Well, I guess, if you want to make that point. But he says, I'm going to abstain from now into the kingdom. So that's my thinking. I'm going to be just like Jesus. I'm going to abstain now into the kingdom. And if he pushes a glass of wine in front of me in the kingdom age and says, okay, Adam, cheers, I'm just going to drink it right to the dregs in the kingdom. I will have a resurrected body then. I think I'll be able to metabolize wine okay, and I don't think I'll drive drunk or beat my wife or anything silly like that. Okay, now I think abstinence is the way to go. I don't make such a, it's not the only sin or anything. Drunkenness is a sin. Having a glass of wine, I, in all truth, I can't say that's sinful, but I don't want to have any part of it. I don't want to send somebody on a bender. I don't want to set a bad example. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. What hymn? Probably Psalm 110. Not exactly sure. It just says sung a hymn. It would be one of the hymns of that time. One of the, they call them the hymns of degrees or the hymns of ascent. It's the one they went up to Jerusalem, the songs that they sang in the book of Psalms. So they sang a hymn. And again, if you say Psalm 110, bind the sacrifice to the altar with cords to the altar. I mean, that would be a very poignant thing to sing as they're going into Gethsemane. So they went out to the Mount of Olives. So they're in transition. They're at the Mount of Olives. They're still in the room. We don't exactly know. It's just off to the Mount of Olives. That's where they're going. They're going to pray. Then saith Jesus unto them, all ye shall be offended because of me this night, for it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad. This is also in Zechariah. We can go back and look at that. But basically it says just like that, smite the shepherd, and the sheep are scattered. I think of this verse, and I apply it to myself in, you know, if Satan attacks me and I fall into sin, I mean, public humiliating sin, will the sheep be scattered? I don't ever want to find out. Should such a man as I be involved in something like that where the possibility is that sheep could be scattered? I've seen it in people's lives. I've seen them make a shipwreck of their faith, and it's never pretty. And there's always some people who are dashed on the shoals, they're shipwrecked right along with the shepherd, and they'll, well, I'll never be part of that again. So they leave the flock because the shepherd is proved to be a human being or not keeping charge of the sheep. Think about that pretty often. Like, I don't ever want to be that. But Jesus is prophesying about himself. He's saying, you're going to all be offended because this is what Scripture says. But after I am risen again, I will go before you into Galilee. He's after the arrest, they're not meeting with him anymore. They're not talking with him. So he's, okay, this is the plan going forward. All right? So this is what I want you to do. Peter answered and said to him, though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet will I never be offended. Jesus said unto him, verily I say unto thee, this night before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. Peter said unto him, though I should die with thee, yet will I not deny thee. Likewise also said all the disciples. Peter has some confidence. Can we say that bravery is his long suit? He's going to take on the whole Roman guard there that come to arrest the temple guard, that come to arrest Jesus. He's ready to take them all on, his whole band of men. All right, Jesus, you and me, let's go. He's got, remember, here are two swords. He's got one of them, right? He cuts off the ear of Malchus' servant. Malchus, the servant of the high priest. He's ready to take them on. You think this guy's a coward? Because I don't. You'll fall mostly in your long suit. In your short suit, when you're being tempted, like, oh, God, every time this happens, it doesn't end up good. Help me. God will help you. What happens when in our long suit? You know what I mean by long suit? It's the thing that we think, this isn't a problem. I got this. Who's got this? Not God. You're not praying. You're thinking you're awesome. And I think there's some... He's self-confident. He's boastful to the point of going forward. We can't have that. You've got to be confident in the Lord. You can't be confident in yourself. That doesn't work. It doesn't work in the kingdom. God won't bless self-confidence. We ask somebody to be an elder and they say, me? Are you kidding me? I like that answer. Well, it's about time you got around to asking me. I've been waiting for so long. I know I'm your man. That guy, he's scary. I don't know that I want to ask him. Self-confidence is not a wonderful trait, and here he's exhibiting it. Though all men, I can see, Jesus, I can see your point. These punks, I get it. They'll punk out. They'll turn their back and run. But I would never do that. I will never be offended. Oh yeah, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. Though I die with thee, did he mean that? Was he sincere? I'm sure he was. I'm sure he meant it. Have you promised the Lord? Oh yeah, absolutely. This is the way it's gonna play out, and it didn't play out that way. That's one of the reasons why vows are such a stupid thing. You have to believe in your ability to keep your end of the bargain. I think that's wrong thinking altogether. And so everyone else rallies. So likewise also said all the disciples. Then cometh Jesus with them to a place called Gethsemane. Olive press, right? And saith unto the disciples, sit ye hence while I go and pray yonder. He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. Then saith the end of them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me. Because he's struggling and he's looking for fellowship. There's something about American men, when we struggle, we want to be all by ourselves, but that's the time when we need brothers around us the most. He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from thee. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. Now, we'll stop here for tonight. It's a good place to stop. But we got a few more minutes, and I just want this thought. We have, there's no denying it, we have a heart's desire. We have an agenda. We have things we want to do. And the servant of God yields to God's He's, I said before, he's the sovereign. He's the one who has the option what pieces to move around the chessboard to his advantage, what he wants. That's hard because we're Americans and we get to choose and we're free and we can do what we want to do. Yeah, you can. Free will is an awful thing that he's given us. It really, really is. And the wisest, best thing is to give it right back to him. That's my opinion on the subject, and I think I have some wisdom when I say that. Give it right back to him, because we can't handle such a gift. It's really beyond us. So, Lord, I don't want this. What has got Jesus this upset? Crown of thorns, being nailed to a tree, mocked, spit at, just total humiliation, agonizing pain. I think the thing that's got him the most rattled is that he knows that God's going to, when he puts on himself the sin of the whole world, God will turn his back on him. He's of pure eyes and can behold sin. And for the first time in forever, that fellowship between Father and Son are broken. And we don't even know that that would happen unless we hear him say from the cross, the only time he ever says, he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? He doesn't call him Father. He calls him my God. And he says, ask the question, why hast thou forsaken me? The answer is not rhetorical. God had forsaken him because he who knew no sin became sin for us that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. Okay, so we know the verse. We know what happened. We understood the whole thing. He doesn't want it. I don't want that. Listen, Father, if you've got plan B, let's bring it out now. Okay, if you got something that you had, you know, like Abraham, right? The old sacrifice Isaac. Nope, we got a ram right here. Everything's good. Yeah, let's do that. You got a plan B, let's do it. I want to say, if there was any other way to save humanity, Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane was not answered. When he goes to the cross, what is that? It's Father God saying, there is no other way. So here we are. Hey, you going to heaven when you die? Oh yeah, I think so. Why? I'm a good person. That's so stunningly wrong answer. It just takes your breath away, doesn't it? Father, if there's any other way, hey, just let them be a bunch of good persons. How's that? How's that? You know, when you shake that, does it rattle? Is there some substance to that? Right. Well, I'm a religious person. Anything other than Jesus' blood paying the penalty for our sins, him who knew no sin, becoming sin for us that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. If there's any other way, God didn't answer his prayer. Did God answer his prayer? Yes. It's not as I will, but as thou wilt. Okay. You sure about this, son? Because that's what's going to happen. And you're going to save the whole worldwide world by this act, everyone who wants to take advantage of it. And there it is. So he says a prayer that we should pray often, you know, because sometimes I think that's a way out of, so we don't have to have faith, you know. Well, it was God's will. And I don't want to teach that. I don't want to promote that. Sometimes God wants us to exhibit faith. But he doesn't want us to exhibit faith against his will. Because at the end of the day, he gets to decide. He gets to call the shots. Here's God calling the shots. And it is the death of his son. Now, Mary looks on and the question she would ask is, why? Ostensibly, I don't know. Never met the lady. Why? Is there a good answer for her? Really, really good one. Maybe it's nothing as a mother at that time she could receive. I'm sure that question has been answered since. So we say, Lord, not my will, but yours be done. And then the child we're praying for dies. The parent we're praying for dies. The whole thing starts moving sideways. And we say, what went on? I was praying. God has a will. Here it's beautiful. I know. You would see Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion, and it looks like a tragedy. I get that. And I'm not trying to be critical. I don't think I'd make a better movie. But it's not a tragedy at all. It's the greatest achievement that's ever been in the history of mankind, the salvation of humanity, the greatest achievement ever. Because God said, no, you're going through with it, son. This cup's not going to pass from you. You're going to take it. You're going to turn it upside down. You're going to drink it to the dregs. It's the wrath of my fury. It solves the problem, doesn't it? He's really upset with us. We have sinned up a storm. And Jesus says, hey, let me pay the penalty. When you get a parking ticket, they don't care who pays it. They don't care who pays it. You're saying, oh, you think this is like a parking ticket situation? No. God has a problem. He wants to fellowship with us, and he can't. He's holy, and we're wicked, beyond wicked. And the Son says, hey, let me make a way where I'll impart my holiness to them. I'll take away their wicked, and now you two can fellowship. God went through an enormous... what he did to save us is so incredible.